people could be caught off guard with the water levels being a little bit higher than they usually are.
Flooding concerns for interior rivers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, Memorial Day, May 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, checking the future water supply for Anchorage.
There's a lot of interesting things here, but that's the most interesting thing to the utilities is how much water they're getting out of this glacier and how that's changing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Significant rain over the weekend in the Fairbanks area is prompting flood advisories for several rivers and streams. National Weather Service meteorologist Corey Bogal says around 2 inches of rain has fallen, and there's concern about recreational boaters.
Usually around Memorial Day weekend, the river levels are pretty low. So this is more typical of what we would see later in the summer. People could be caught off guard with the water levels being a little bit higher than they usually are, and the currents being stronger than you'd typically expect in late May.
Bogal says water levels have been high on the Chena, Good Pastor, and Salcha rivers, and even the Tanana. The Good Pastor flooded an airstrip and equipment yard at the Pogo mine. Bogal says the rainy weather pattern is unusual for the spring.
More typical of July and August, where we have low pressure down in the Gulf of Alaska, and we get disturbances that kind of move from east to west across the area and produce rainfall.
Bogal says it's hard to predict rainfall from this type of pattern and cautions that weather is expected to remain unsettled with showers in the forecast. Nearly an inch of rain fell yesterday between miles 80 and 112 on the Steese Highway, and flooding there was likely. Drivers are urged not to attempt to drive through water covering the road. The U.S. House and Senate are out of session at the moment. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, when the two chambers return from the Memorial Day recess, they'll have a full plate.
July is usually reserved for appropriations, the giant bills that fund all the different agencies of the government. Congress has been writing and marking up all sorts of appropriations bills, getting them ready for up or down votes come summertime. It's the heavy lifting the government must do, or it will need to pass a continuing resolution, an agreement to keep the government afloat for a certain period of time. Appropriations bills are always political, and this year, with an election looming in November and August reserved for campaigning, that will likely be the case. Though the Senate has shown some signs it wants to move some bills along quickly. It passed a reauthorization for the Food and Drug Administration with 96 yes votes last week, though Senator Lisa Murkowski's so-called Frankenfish amendment to the bill failed. The two chambers will also have to take up other controversial measures, one that would prevent student interest rates from increasing in July. It's already failed in the Senate, but it will try and move it again. Congress also must pass a massive reauthorization to pay for the country's roads, highways, and bridges. Each chamber has passed a version, and a conference committee is now melding the two. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Anchorage is one of the only cities in North America dependent on a glacier for most of its drinking water. The Aklutna Glacier also provides about 15% of the city's electricity in the form of hydropower. And it's an ideal outdoor laboratory for an intrepid group of Alaska Pacific University students who are working to answer one very important question: how long will the glacier last? APRN's Annie Feit dropped in on their research project for an afternoon and has this story.
The first thing you learn about glacier research is that there's a lot of shoveling involved, especially after a record snow winter. It doesn't look like easy work, but glaciologist Louis Sass is a shoveling machine, flinging pristine snow out of a rapidly expanding snow pit.
Even when it never melts, it gets to be the consistency of sort of really strong styrofoam once you get down maybe 6 or 8 feet.
It may be a tough job, but it comes with a view. The White Glacier sprawls out around Sass. It looks kind of like a huge lake covered by a giant fluffy marshmallow, rimmed by sharp peaks. It's stunning. Mike Loso is the Alaska Pacific University professor leading the Aklutna Glacier research.
You know, if you look around, you understand why the guys at the water treatment plant that work for Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility, they say they have the best job in the world because, you know, there's water treatment guys in New York and everywhere else in the country that have to deal with these foul, nasty rivers and make them into drinking water. And the guys here just have to turn this into drinking water. They just have to figure out how not to screw it up.
Those guys at the water treatment plant and the power plant are funding part of this research. They want to know how much water they can expect from the glacier in the years ahead. Like most glaciers in Alaska, the Aklutna Glacier is shrinking rapidly. So 6 years ago, Loso started bringing his Alaska Pacific University students out into the field to study the problem. They spend 3 weeks each May camping on the glacier, skiing to several research plots to gather data. On this afternoon, that means weighing cake-sized pieces of snow sliced from the wall of the snow pit.
Ooh, nice ones, Trevor. That's a nice one.
He's the man.
Student Trevor Golden slides the snow into a Ziploc bag. Abe Meyerhofer weighs it with a portable scale.
280?
280.
These precise measurements will help the team determine how much snow has accumulated on the glacier this winter. They also need to figure out how much it will melt this summer. So another group of students is getting ready to plant a 20-foot aluminum stake in the glacier. But first, they need to tunnel a deep hole into the dense snow to make a pocket for the stake. And that requires a special tool.
Who wants to use a steam drill?
Junior Haley Williams volunteers. This is her first science expedition on the glacier, and she jumped at the chance to take the course.
I'm an earth science major, and I have a fascination with glaciers and volcanoes. So I'm trying to figure out which I like better. So I figured I'd come out here and give this a shot and see if I have what it takes to be a glaciologist.
Right now, that means learning to use the steam drill with a small team of students.
We'll turn this on to turn the propane on, and then we'll just push this button like that.
The contraption looks like a miniature fireman's hose with a pointy nozzle that will shoot steam into the snowpack to drill the hole. Professor Jason Geck gives instructions as they fire it up.
Okay, so you can just stick it out, and I'm just going to shoot water in the air from just by getting all the water out of the line.
Yeah.
And you can probably go ahead and just keep it vertical.
Go for
yep,
it.
Yep, keep it vertical.
As soon as the hose hits the snow, the drill goes silent.
Some music playing for this moment.
In a few short minutes, the hole is drilled. When the pole is planted, they'll come back to this spot during the fall to see how much more of it is exposed to measure snow melt. Mike Loso says all of the measurements his students are taking on the glacier are working towards one objective.
And the goal is to sort of reduce this snowpack numerically to what we call water equivalent, which is if you melted all the snow we got this winter, how much water would you get? Because that's really, there's a lot of interesting things here, but that's the most interesting thing to the utilities is how much water they're getting out of this glacier and how that's changing.
The research project shows even though the glacier is shrinking, Anchorage will be able to draw water and power from it for at least the next century. And even once it's gone, the mountains will still feed water into Aklutna Lake. But until then, the amount of yearly melt the utilities can expect from the glacier will change. And Loso says the long-term prognosis is for less water.
Does that mean we don't have electricity or there no water comes out of the tap? No. But it does mean that an exceptional source of super clean, really cheap water for both the water and the power utilities is going to have to be augmented by what are likely to be more expensive sources of water and electricity.
Loso says it will eventually matter to Anchorage residents in their pocketbooks, and that reality will seep in slowly over several decades. For now, though, Loso's team is getting ready to place the giant stake in the hole they tunneled with the steam drill.
Yeah, let's get it vertical, and then we'll all kind of let it go at the same time. Oh, okay, everybody good? that's the way it's supposed to go in. There we have it.
When they're done, only a small piece of aluminum is sticking out of the glacier. When they come back later this fall, they'll be able to see how much snow has melted. Loso says he personally is hoping for a hot summer, which would mean lots of melt, but the glacier would prefer it stayed cold. For APRN, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, keeping kids safe online.
Just as you wouldn't allow them to take the car in the middle of the night, you really shouldn't allow them to have full internet access in the middle of the night either.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
A group of freshmen on this year's University of Alaska Fairbanks swim team are making waves on the national scene. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, one of the athletes is training in California for a shot at the Olympic trials.
This isn't the first time the University of Alaska Fairbanks women's swimming coach will train an athlete for Olympic trials. Scott Lemley trained another swimmer early in his career, but he says this time around, he expects it to be a lot more fun.
Back in 1988, I'd only been coaching for 10 years, but now it's not going to be that stressful. I know a lot more about how to prepare an athlete.
Lemley is in San Diego with Margot Adams, who just finished her freshman year swimming at UAF. Adams was the national runner-up in the 100-yard butterfly at the NCAA Division II National Championships in Texas this past spring. Her time in that race was just over 1 second away from the Olympic trial cut.
Well, athletically, she's a gifted swimmer. She's tall. She has great biomechanics. But probably the most important thing to know about her is the mental part, the ability to focus on every stroke and every practice and just the commitment to do her best all the time.
By Lemley's count, Adams could become Alaska's fifth swimmer to qualify for Olympic trials. This is Adams' first attempt at making the trials, but she says there's no pressure.
I know that I have a lot of support from my family and friends, but I don't think that there's a lot of stress because this is a first for me. So I don't think I have any pressures to make the trials the first time.
Adams will swim the 100-meter butterfly at the Santa Clara Invitational in California on June 1st. If she doesn't make the cut during the race, she has two other opportunities to swim in a time trial. If she does qualify, Adams will head to Omaha, Nebraska for Olympic trials the last week in June. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Anchorage Police Department Detective Glenn Klinkhart recently retired from APD after 17 years on the force, but he's hardly kicking back. Klinkhart helped launch the cybercrimes unit at APD a decade ago. Now, five full-time officers work not only on computer forensics, but are online catching child predators. He's written a new book to aid parents in keeping their kids safe online. He says the internet has allowed those with ill intent to have access to children and communicate with them, but it's also let law enforcement have access too. Klinkhart says his book gives an overview of the internet and also gets into specifics parents should know about.
Such as internet protocol addresses, why those are important. Talking about things more specific now, that we've got the tablets, we've got the iPads, we've got the kids have smartphones, not just cell phones anymore, but these kids have computers attached, you know, to them. And that adds a whole nother level of concern that parents need to be aware of. So when you talk about if I was to encompass a lot of what's in this book, it's about being aware of those things, just as parents have to be aware that your kids are on bikes, you don't want them to be hurt, so you make them wear a helmet. They need to know that your child having a Facebook page, having Twitter, having a cell phone that has 24 hours a day, you know, connectivity has some risks, and you need to mitigate those risks
by setting up rules. Just as you wouldn't allow them to take the car in the middle of the night, you really shouldn't allow them to have full internet access in the middle of the night either.
I know that parents can lock their kids out of certain cable channels. If they have cable television in their home, they can set it up so that kids can't get on certain channels. Is it as simple a process to do something similar online where people can block certain sites for their kids? Or what do you recommend in that regard?
Well, and that's another reason why I put the book together. There are actually some free, easy-to-use things that are they're minor, and they're little bits and things that you can do, and I actually have some instruction in the book. For example, some people don't know that Google, the big search engine, has a preferences setting that you can set to filter the results, and they actually do a very good job of filtering it. So if you turn on that filtering to your Google when your family searches on things, so for example, I like to use the one where if your child is doing a report on breast cancer awareness, they're not going to get porn if those filters are set. That's completely free and actually with two or three clicks can be done. But I also warn in the book that that's not an end-all. It does go down to having rules and talking about it.
Do you suggest, as many do, that your children's computer should be in an open area, shouldn't be in their bedroom? And is there an age at which you think that should shift? When do we start trusting them so that they can have access without our constant eye?
The first part is yes. I still believe that parents need to physically put boundaries on the computer, and especially the younger kids, being able to so that they know. And as they get older, they also know that your parents know what's going on and can see. So you can have that control. But you're absolutely right. As your children grow and become, you know, decision makers, as much as we don't like them to, a good example would be my son, who is just turned 14, has been getting on his father about having Facebook for the last couple of years. So here I am having to read my own book and talk to him about it. So, and again, at some point he needed to have that freedom and needed to be able to have that contact. So, but we had rules. We set up these rules that he could have a Facebook, but I had to be his friend on Facebook and I have to have his username and password. The other thing that I told him is, guess what? Having these decisions and being able to make these decisions on your own about what you post and who you contact and who your friends are does come with some responsibility. So guess what? You are going to be responsible for this on your Facebook, but not just you, but your friends as well. So that invites him to have a conversation with his friends. Don't post anything because I'm going to get in trouble or I have rules that I have to abide by.
I like the idea of having the username and password. That's a good decision for a parent. Do you then check on that every now and then to make sure he doesn't change the password?
And yes, but I think maybe around the check, you can just simply have a conversation with them so that they don't have that feeling like you're checking on them. But, you know, an interesting kind of parallel is those parents who ask about, do you look at your child's diary? You know, do you go into the room and search it now and again? My personal advice from a police officer who does a lot of searches is you need to have some reason to it. Again, it's that having that respect and allowing them to grow and make decisions, and they need to know that if they give you probable cause, to use a legal term, to do that, I think that that's well within. You can then play the heavy, but you don't need to be the heavy all the time. You got to give them that room.
Glenn Klinkhart is a retired APD detective and author of the new book, A Cyber Cop's Guide to Internet Child Safety. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It can be difficult for scientists to show other people why they love what they love because it's hard to translate science. Two science geeks at the University of Alaska Fairbanks use relatable anecdotes to keep their audiences hooked. UAF student Kelsey Gabrowski tells us how.
I'm walking down a hallway at UAF looking for Harris when in one room I hear a radio playing dance music? I find Harris there with his graduate student, Jess St. Laurent. He's stooped over a shaved rat on a table. He coaches her through the procedure as tubes and instruments clutter the work area.
Now that's pump.
Oh, no.
No, that's fine. Because it's not huge.
Okay.
And we can work that out. So, cool.
Harris guides me away from the crowded laboratory, back to his office.
So what did I just walk into earlier? I heard a party going on when I was walking down the hall. And
That is more or less typical environment within our lab.
Harris tells me they had been preparing a rat for a brainstem experiment for St. Laurent's graduate research. The brainstem controls unconscious processes such as breathing. They tend to listen to music to relax and keep track of how quickly they're getting through an experiment. Now, Harris does all he can to hook people into science and keep them thinking. For example, there was one point when St. Laurent asked for help.
Decrease the pump by 2 RPMs and do it again. Increase the pump and do it again. And let's get a range of...
Can you help me with that?
Yes, absolutely. But basically, you're running the pump...
Eventually, St. Laurent won't need help prepping for this experiment. Someday, she'll need to learn a harder procedure. But because Harris walked her through this dissection, she gets it. She sees the results of her actions.
Everybody could benefit from critical thinking. Everybody could benefit from making decisions based on evidence rather than making, you know, gut decisions or decisions that aren't well considered.
Now here's the challenge in pulling people into neurobiology and animal physiology. There are students taking Harris's class who plan to go to medical school, and there are other students who plan to study wildlife. Harris has to figure out how to hook both of them. To start getting students engaged and thinking logically, Harris pulls inspiration from his own life. He loves graphic novels, especially those about zombies, and that passion worked its way into his teaching style.
I mean, I can talk about comparative physiology of different animal species that engages the wildlife biologists, and I can talk about clinical examples that engages the pre-professional, pre-medical students, but shockingly, everybody's engaged when I talk about zombies.
Harris finds that teaching his class at a basic level keeps everyone engaged, even the advanced students. Like Harris, science writer Ned Rozelle works with a varied audience when he writes for the UAF Geophysical Institute. To approach this challenge, Rozelle funnels his audience of hundreds of thousands down to one person.
For years, I've usually thought of writing to my mother, who is a great reader, but certainly not a scientist.
Since the mid-90s, Rozelle's written more than 700 articles for the weekly Alaska Science Forum. Rozelle tries to keep scientific jargon out of his stories.
Yeah, I think that probably comes naturally to me, because I like stories, and I think it's a good way to keep a reader engaged.
Rozelle spends a lot of time outdoors. Just as talking with a person helps you understand who they are, walking in the woods shows Rozelle how to tell the story of the world around him. Rozelle takes me outside to the UAF trail system.
Well, there's our Junco. See him? He's on top of the spruce tree.
Okay. Yeah.
Welcome to Fairbanks, Junco. Oh yeah, right now we're in a mixed forest, sort of, with aspens and birch, spruce. It's pretty open right now without the leaves.
Rozelle's written about many of the birds and plants in this forest. Everything from the spring leaf out to junco brains.
Yeah, it's just a really pleasant place.
The research part of campus, where Rozelle's office is, bumps up against the south side of the trail system. Rozelle lives on the north side.
Yeah, I spend a ton of time here. Mm-hmm. I often commute to work on the trails, and I walk my dog on the trails. I basically live on them.
Rozelle's a lot like Harris. The natural world drew them in. They can stand outside, or in the lab, and appreciate the beauty in what's around them. They notice more details now that they know how junco brains and rat hearts work. But not everyone sees these details. Rozelle and Harris try to help their audiences notice how science threads through their everyday lives. These two science lovers hold up a magnifying glass to the world through the stories they tell. In Fairbanks, I'm Kelsey Gabrowski.
170 Alaska Air National Guard troops are getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan. Rex Gray is a parent of one of those citizen soldiers. His son, Ben, is heading off on his first deployment. In this commentary, Rex reflects on what the experience means to him.
He's leaving for Afghanistan, heading to a forward operating base, to fly a Pave Hawk, a Black Hawk helicopter modified to rescue downed airmen, Marines in tight spots, and who knows what else. He loves to fly. His first airplane ride was in a Grumman Widgeon to Inukuk Lake in the Brooks Range. He was 6 months old. Sitting on his mother's lap, he tried to wrap his little fingers around the control yoke. After landing, he burped up his milk, but was still all smiles. That was 29 years ago. He spent a lot of his growing up time in a little airplane sitting beside me. Old enough to hold the control wheel, he would keep the wings level, or sometimes just look out the window. It was no surprise when he turned 15 he wanted to learn to fly. Flying in Alaska is wonderful but risky. Some of my pilot friends have died. If he was going to be a pilot, I wanted to make sure he could recognize and deal with the risk. He is my son. I would be his flight instructor. I wanted to make sure he knew everything he needed to know to give him the best odds of surviving. We did spins, practice landings in big crosswinds, flew in bad weather, intentionally. Sure, we had the traditional father-teenage-son conflicts, but he learned, and before I knew it, he was 17 and a private pilot. I'll be fine, he said. I checked the weather. I watched him fly up the Matanuska River Valley in that little green airplane we had spent so many hours in together. A towering thunderstorm over Sutton was trying to block the valley in his route. No worries. He's been well trained, I told myself. Seems just like yesterday. A teenage pilot off to see another teenager living in the Wrangells. She is now his wife and is also saying goodbye. Almost 200 men and women are deploying. Most are citizen soldiers or weekend warriors. They are helicopter pilots, C-130 pilots, PJs or pararescue men, mechanics, crew chiefs, gunners, and support personnel. Their business is saving people. Last year, 104 to be exact. There are neighbors, co-workers, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, sons and daughters, willing to do their duty, rescue people they don't know, halfway around the world in a hostile environment. They'll be gone 120 days. I taught him everything I knew about flying and risk management in that little green airplane, the Champ. I didn't teach him how to avoid enemy fire in a low-flying helicopter. He assured me the Air Force has. In 120 days, my son and all the others will return home safely. I'm looking forward to that day when we can go fly the little green airplane together again. I'm sure he'll have a lot to teach me.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass and Emily Schwing and Kelsey Gabrowski in Fairbanks. We had commentary tonight from Rex Gray. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. and Annie Fite from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.